we're in the information age, but facts are in short supply. Reject the noise, ask bold questions, and pursue the truth with FBI whistleblowers and founding suspendables Garrett O'Boyle and Steve Brenn. This is the American Radicals Podcast.
It is the American Radicals Podcast. Thanks for being here today on a Saturday. Rumble.com/AmRadPod. While you're here, make sure that you smash the like button and follow the show. We're over 2,000 followers right now, trying to grow as fast as we can, and we appreciate your support. If you listen to the audio format of the podcast, make sure that you subscribe so you get the updates. We have a show every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Saturday is always the most fun because we can go a little bit longer. We can really dig into some issues, not as much of a time crunch. Plus, we know that we have no cobwebs in anybody's eyes or brains because we're a little later. You're normally during the week at 8:30. On the weekends, we let you sleep in, and it's a 12 p.m. Eastern time start for the American Radicals Podcast. Today is kind of a special day because, you know, it's 4:20. Are you partaking? I'm not, because I want to actually own a firearm in America. I'll have to ask my counterpart here at GOB Actual on 4:20. Are you good to go, sir? Are you ready to actually dig into some issues? Because we've got some fun stuff today. We're going to talk about some whistleblower history and how it pertains to you and my situation.
I'm ready to go. None of the devil's lettuce for me today. And I don't plan on it anytime soon. So we're
firing. I remember that being a thing, man. That was a thing in high school. The kids were like, oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be great.
Come on, let's chief, bro.
And I mean, you're living near Wisconsin, Madison. So, I mean, that had to be heavy duty there.
Oh yeah.
But we don't want to belabor the illegalities. We don't want to give the minders over at the FBI who are consistently watching our program any extra derogatory material they can put into their case files. Thanks, guys. I appreciate the one thumbs down we get on every single episode of the American Radicals Podcast. At least in my mind, that's who's smashing the thumbs down.
We know it's you, Sekhti.
All right. So the topic at hand today, and we have just a couple of them, and that'll give us an opportunity to really dig into them. I came across the history of whistleblowers in the United States, and the history is actually a pretty interesting one. It dates back to before we were actually a country, when it was still, you know, the Constitution hadn't been enacted yet. We were actively engaged in a war with the United Kingdom for our freedom. That's how far back this history goes, because throughout history, there are people who want to do the right thing at the right time, in the right way, and for the right reasons. I kind of wished I could meet those guys. Maybe hand them a suspendables lapel.
Yeah. Hey, put this on your, what were their hats called that they wore?
The tricorners. Yeah. Put it on a tricorner hat. I mean, that would have been a pretty cool emblem. I mean, we sort of have that for the American Radicals emblem. It's the Hamilton.
That's right.
So there is a connection, but I came across this. It was on history.com. It said the U.S. whistleblowers first got government protection in 1777.
But were they really protected?
Well, I don't know if they were actually determined to be whistleblowers, according to the Democrat Congress. There's an entire process that's, I don't know, sort of out there in the ether that nobody knows. If it's convenient, then we call you one. If not, then we say that you're a political partisan and a conspiracy theorist.
I could imagine the 1777 version of Debbie Wasserman Schultz saying, "These are not whistleblowers; they are redcoat spies."
Absolutely. I mean, look, you need to be referred over to the Department of Justice, which hasn't been invented yet, but we're going to invent it just to go after you for this. But if I read here, I'm going to read a couple of excerpts from it because it's a very interesting story. I think that just the history of it, I'm a nerd, and I am proud of the fact that this audience seems to appreciate my nerdiness when it comes to American history particularly. But the whistleblowers who sought protection were 10 American sailors and Marines. They reported improper behavior by the Continental Navy's most powerful man. It went all the way to the top. I never thought about actually talking about Christopher Wray as a whistleblower, but now I'm starting to reconsider that. But they gathered in February 19th, 1777 to sign a petition to the Continental Congress, and they documented the abuses by their commander. And this was a guy named Commodore Isaac Hopkins, the first commander-in-chief of the Continental Navy. He was the George Washington equivalent just in the Navy. According to these 10 whistleblowers, American sailors and Marines, quote, he has been guilty of such crimes as render him quite unfit for the public department he now occupies. I know him to be a man of no principle and quite unfit for the important trust reposed in him. They accused Hopkins of cursing the Continental Congress. So just blaspheming the Continental Congress at that point was a problem. But we were interrogated for being political partisans, I guess, different standards in those days. But according to these whistleblowers, Hopkins called the Continental Congress a pack of damn fools. And he also was treating prisoners in a very unbecoming and barbarous manner, which was violated the orders that the British captives had to be well and humanely treated. So some sort of war atrocities that he was alleging they were committing. That's the first excerpt. Your initial thoughts on that, Garrett?
Well, it's interesting that there was 10 of them. You don't see that today. I mean, good luck if you get what, three, but so that's interesting. But also, it just goes to show that throughout time, throughout history, there have been people with a spine who have said, this is wrong. I'm not going to give in to my look. This has been the theme all week, right? This cowardice theme, or at least for me, it's been on my mind a lot. So I'm not going to lean into my cowardice. And oh, look at this. Look at this. I even have some cohorts with me. And in this case, you know, you're on a ship or whatever. They probably worked, you know, together a lot. And just think about this pragmatically. Like, they're talking. It's like any job. You're in the Navy. You know, you have your friends on the ship with you, and you're talking. You're talking at chow time or while you're swabbing the deck or whatever. And you realize, like, oh, a bunch of us actually think that this high-ranking government official is evil. What are we going to do about that? And they do the right thing. And that, you know, kudos. That's awesome. And already I'm like, when you had the website up, I'm like sitting here like this, like, dude, this is awesome. Like, give me more. So it's cool.
I thought it was interesting because unlike you and me, they didn't have a virtual academy whistleblower protection training. Right. There was no law on the books. The country was in its infancy, and they still said, well, whatever the consequences are, I have to do the right thing. There was not even a structure, even though pretty clear that the structure wasn't followed for you and for me and others like us. Yeah. But at least we could hold on to that semblance of hope that maybe there would be a white knight that would ride in and say, yes, 5 USC 2303 does stand for something and we will protect you. But these guys didn't even have that. They just had to their own honor. And I thought it was actually noteworthy that they were concerned about British prisoners who essentially were their enemy, their mortal enemy that they were sworn to oppose, because those were the tyrants they were fighting to fend off. But they said, look, there's still rules of engagement here and we can't treat them in this barbarous manner. We have to be gentlemanly in that. And the Commodore Hopkins was not following along. We'll go back to this piece here as we get into what the ramifications were. So Hopkins was actually immediately suspended. They did, I think, a job here. They said, look, there's a reasonable concern here. We're going to push pause on his duties while this is hanging over his head. So this was January 2nd of 1778.
Let me just interject here for a second. Look at this. So right off the bat, when they didn't even have a whistleblower protection law, they did the right thing. And they said, no, this Commodore is the one who needs to get suspended. We got 10 guys who are like, hey, this dude is off the rails. And look today. Oh, dude, it's just crazy. Because look today. Now you get dragged before Congress and you get demeaned and slandered. And in my case, referred criminally to DOJ. And
oh, we're coming to that, Garrett.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I will get there.
No, we're coming to that in this story as well.
Oh, okay. Oh,
yes.
Great.
Because
oh,
no. Some things apparently are just don't change. They never change. History has a way of repeating.
I spoke too soon. Typical.
The disgraced Commodore lashed out and filed a criminal libel suit in Rhode Island against the 10 petitioners and two actual Rhode Island residents. This guy named Richard Marvin and another one named Samuel Shaw. And those two Rhode Island residents, I don't know what their connection was. They weren't the 10 sailors and Marines. I wasn't able to ascertain who they and how they were actually related to this, but they were arrested and jailed because of the Commodore's complaint. He had connections in Rhode Island and had these guys locked up. So these pair of citizens appealed to the Continental Congress for help and writing that they were arrested for doing what they believed and still believe was nothing but their duty. The Continental Congress responded by passing a law to protect the men and future whistleblowers. Now, here's a quote from the law, or from the Continental Congress. It is the duty of all persons in the service of the United States, as well as all other inhabitants thereof, to give the earliest information to Congress or any other proper authority of any misconduct, frauds, or misdemeanor committed by any officers or persons in the service of these states, which may come to their knowledge. Read the resolution, approved July 30th, 1778. I keep reading the dates, and we'll get to that in a minute, but initial reaction on the fact that Congress actually stepped up and immediately took action to protect the whistleblowers. I don't know if it had anything to do because they were personally insulted by this Hopkins. Maybe that was why, but not so today, Garrett.
Yeah, not so today. But I mean, even that 1778, the infancy of our nation. Look, certainly politics played a role even then. Like, of course, I mean, as much as I hate to say it, because like we want to look back at our founding fathers and think like they were these, you know, beacons of and perfect men, and they weren't. I mean, certainly, I think we can look to them and say, more manly, more resolute, probably more truthful in a lot of ways than our politicians are today. But in the early stages of our country, here we get this whistleblower protection law. I mean, it's astounding to me. I'm pumped for this episode. I'm loving it so far. And what you just read from Congress back then in 1778 is not at all dissimilar from the laws we have now. 5 U.S.C. 7211 gives us, well, any current applicant or former federal employee gives them the right to petition Congress, and then 5 U.S.C. 2302 and 5 U.S.C. 2303 are the whistleblower protection statutes for that covers all the federal agencies. So we had it in 1778 and we allegedly have it in 2024. But Steve and I wouldn't be sitting here if those laws actually meant anything.
And I mentioned the dates, and I think they're kind of noteworthy, especially in light of your timeline. So the 10 whistleblowers, they drafted and they met in February 1777. The Commodore was removed in January 1778. So, and you also have to realize they didn't have email, right? So there's a lag in time. That has to be accounted for. But it took 11 months for him to be removed. And then he immediately files this libel complaint in Rhode Island. And the Continental Congress passes this resolution to support it, to support the guys who were actually arrested, and they funded their defense.
Oh, how about that?
They wouldn't you know it? They funded their defense.
I still haven't even been reimbursed for my travel to my deposition or to when we went to testify.
They,
Congress,
but this happened in
$100, you know, that's it.
This happened in July, 1778. That's how quick it was that they took action. So we're talking 6 months from taking action to then passing this resolution, unlike the whistleblower protection law that's now being proposed by the Judiciary Committee, which will never pass and is unhelpful, as we've elaborated on in the past. Yeah. We're coming up on 11 months since we have testified, over a year since we brought our concerns forward, and the clock is still running. The meter on the cab is still ticking up on them coming in to support financially people who were victims of weaponization and faced retribution because they did the right thing and came forward with their reasonable concerns. I guess the Continental Congress was more on the ball than our current elected officials who have the benefit of email and cell phones. Maybe they should just get off of Twitter for a minute or two and actually do their jobs.
They won't do that, as we all know. No. Twitter is life, bro.
Hey, this is one of the scariest lessons that I've learned, and that will allow me this slight departure from the subject at hand here. And I definitely want to get your thoughts too. I can't believe the amount of people in the positions of authority, elected officials, who think that X, formerly Twitter, is real life. And they're on it all day long. All you have to look at is if you go to any one of their accounts, the frequency in which they're posting, and it might be staffers doing it. I have my doubts, though. I think that those guys are on it, which is why when I and you were testifying, they were tweeting while we were testifying. They're on it and addicted to it nonstop. So they have no semblance of what's reality, what is real conversation. And then they live up near Capitol Hill, so they have no sense of reality of like what real America looks like, even if they're touching the grass on these perfectly manicured lawns.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely insane. I think you probably have a better lead onto that than I do. But yeah, you can go to any of them. And it doesn't matter the side. RRD, they're on there tweeting stuff all the time, all just trying to make a name, get retweets by big accounts, get so they can get on CNN or Fox, depending on whichever side you're on. And it's like, these are the people who are running our country. Like,
well, Sebastian Gorka covered earlier this week on this particular issue.
Oh,
he had information given to him that said that the witnesses that they were actually inviting to testify at these hearings, which hearings for hearing's sake, I guess here having a hearing is considered a victory.
Yeah.
Separate topic. But according to Dr. Gorka, he has sources that have told him that they are inviting particular witnesses because they have a large Twitter following.
Oh, how about that? That's why you're getting a Matt Taibbi and a Michael Schellenberger.
Those are the names.
Jordan Peterson. You know, like, dude, we're not a serious nation. We just aren't. We just aren't.
Strategically, if I thought they were good actors, I would think there's kind of an angle. Hey, these people have a good following. If they share it, more Americans will become aware of what's going on.
Okay,
but I know what it is. Yeah. They are hoping to get more Twitter followers themselves.
Right.
So gross.
Yeah. Because what is my 5-minute interaction going to be like with this person to help me get more followers on my X account, like,
which is why they don't let them talk.
Yeah,
they just invite them there.
Yeah, which we know that too. They just read off their sheet. Oh man, dude, it's just it's so absurd. You know, you mentioned our logo in the beginning with Hamilton. Like, I think of, and just with this history of whistleblowers, like these one, Hamilton and some of these guys, they were teenagers in the early stages of forming this country, and they went to war. And then they became politicians or whatever else they did to help, you know, stand up the country. And now it's just Twitter. Like, dude, I'm sorry. This is the decline of a nation. This is Rome, you know, 600 years into its existence. Like, it's over. It's coming to an end.
That's like, why I try to put things in perspective about, you know, what is hard. And people come to you, and I imagine you probably get the same sort of unease when people say things to you that are very complimentary, like, oh, what you're doing is so brave, the sacrifice you made. And you definitely have. And I just always go back to, you know, George Washington, when he was 14, was like, I'm going to go survey Pennsylvania, which was uninhabited at the time. And just like went into the mountains
when he
was
14.
And you have
14, like, think of that.
You had families that were in Europe that were like, hey, let's get on this boat called the Mayflower to go get religious freedom. And we'll look around at my 9 kids and be like, hey, a couple of you aren't going to make the trip. Right. Are just not going to survive it. We know that, but we're going anyway.
We're going.
Like, that's bravery. I mean, we're at least at this point able to have the comfort of air conditioning and heat in the winter. And we can communicate in Wisconsin and Florida to each other immediately via text message or podcast form, and hash out our ideas and sit comfortably in our chairs. You know, and we're on the hill that was chosen for us. We're definitely going to fight on it, but there's a definitely a different level of severity. I want to get back to close this article out on the history of whistleblowers, because we're going to move out of the American Revolutionary War and onto the Civil War here. And this was, again, history.com. U.S. whistleblowers first got government protection in 1777. But if you jump forward almost a full century, unscrupulous contractors defrauded the Union Army by selling it shoddy goods such as uniforms that disintegrated in the rain, artillery shells with gunpowder laced with sawdust, and rotted ships coated with fresh paint. Lacking money to hire an army of inspectors, the federal government instead authorized the public to act as whistleblowers. They deputized all Americans to act as whistleblowers with the passage of the False Claims Act of 1863, also known as the Lincoln Law, which is still on the books now. You can adhere to this and make protected disclosures about the government being bilked. Now, I think the government's not really worried about being bilked anymore with the amount of money that they spend.
Yeah. So they don't want to be bilked because they line their own pockets along the way.
I wonder how many Lincoln Law, complaints come through. I don't know if they have like any guidance for the legislative aid when you walk into the congressman's office and say, I have a Lincoln Law complaint, but it's still in the books. And at that point, at least the federal government was concerned about getting ripped off, and they deputized the American people, because the expectation was that the American people would do the right thing, the right time, the right way, for the right reasons, and not try to personally profit, and actually to report those who were, because that was anti-constitutional, that was anti-American.
Man, think of how even that has changed so drastically. Like, wow, I think of just a ton of examples. You can get discounted phones or free phones, you know, like remember the whole Obama phone thing? Guess what? That still exists. That's still
for illegal aliens at the southern border. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can get, you know, EBT or whatever else with limited, you can get on all these government programs is what I'm saying. I don't care which one. I think of when we lived in Kansas, there was this, I don't remember when it started. I think it was before COVID. Maybe. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was before COVID, because like all these other, even, okay, so our kids didn't go to public school, government didn't go to government school. And, you know, like the homeschool community, like we've met other people from church who did that. But like all these moms would be like, oh, Heidi, are you, my wife, are you going to go get lunches? And Heidi's like, what are you talking about? And you can go to the schools and pick up these lunches. And it's like, well, that's kind of antithetical to the whole point of the program. It's supposed to be for people who actually need it. And here in the early stages of our country, the government thought, oh, the people are actually here to help make the nation better, not just take what they can from us. And it's like, that's why these government programs get out of control, is because people just, oh, what can I get from me? And there's all sorts of rationalization, like, well, I pay taxes and, you know, so I'm owed it or whatever. And I always just go back to this. What did Jesus say? Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Just because the government is taxing you unjustly, or you come up with some algorithm in your head to justify taking from Caesar, doesn't mean it's right or okay. You know, like I think of our current circumstances, not the best probably, especially from like a worldly perspective, as far as income and all of those things go. But we're like, we're going to do our best to still live a biblical worldview and not just milk the system like this law was talking about. And it's kind of hard for me to understand how people can get to that point of like, no, I'm just going to do what's best for me. But I guess I could be wrong, but considering both of our history that has led to the AMRAD pod, I guess we don't always think of what would be best for me.
The days of the John F. Kennedy asked not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. If he uttered that today, I don't think he could be elected as a Republican, not even a Democrat. That mentality is gone. And I remember I worked with a police officer who was, you know, a teen mom before it was cool. And I remember her talking to me that she kind of grew up in this impoverished area. She had her daughter very young. And that was how everyone in generations of her family had done things.
That's a hard cycle to get out of.
And the cycle was actually the mentality of it, because they came to her and said, why aren't you signing up for all these welfare benefits? And they were telling her she was irresponsible as a parent for not doing that, because she was depriving her child of these benefits. And she said, no, I'm able-bodied and I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps. And that's so rare.
Wow. That is so rare. It is so rare, man.
Yep. And she wound up joining the army and, and then was a police officer and has moved on since then.
That's awesome. That
story is just not the norm anymore.
And, what's crazy is that's not the norm. And if you actually think about that, that is how you attain the American dream. Working hard, recognizing like, okay, I have to do this. I had a child young out of wedlock. I'm assuming the man probably wasn't in the picture. I could be wrong there, but that's typically what happens. And I think of this probably similar for you. The most exposure I had to this type of life was when I was a cop. You would see it all the time, because they're the ones who, in a lot of ways, they're struggling more than other people in our communities. And so then naturally the police show up there more for whatever reasons. And I actually came to a point this probably, it didn't dawn on me when I was a cop, but by and large, I realized it was more firmly rooted when I was a cop, was, oh, this is modern day slavery. This is how the government keeps people down. They say, I'm going to give you this phone. I'm going to give you this allotment per month. I'm going to make your rent cheaper in Section 8 housing. And then the people buy the myth that that's it. That's the way. That's the way to live a fulfilled life. And I'm going to get on Social Security so I don't have to work. So I get a little bit more every month now. But then they stay at this impoverished level anyways. And so many of them buy into it, and they don't realize that that is the way for the government to keep them in slavery, modern day slavery.
It's the welfare queen's argument that they actually figure out how to hack the system. Well, I get more money if I don't get married, and I have to actually earn less, or I have to cap what I earn, otherwise my benefits will stop. And they try to work smarter and not harder, but there is ultimately a ceiling on what you're able to do. And you just, that's the trap that you're stuck in. Before moving on this, I heard this statistic recently, and it was a biblical question, which I know will strike you. And it was regarding the misreading of, it's easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get to heaven. And as the story goes, this rich man comes to Christ and says, I want to follow you. And Christ tells him, then sell everything you have. Mm-hmm. Because Christ was looking into his heart and realized that he had a love of money. He had an idol of money. It had nothing to do with his finances.
Right.
It was that it was an idol for him. And it frequently gets misapplied, and people just say, well, rich people can't go to heaven. That's just how it is. And the figure that I heard was, you set this up and say, if you believe the ultra wealthy can't get to heaven, do you think the top 1% have no chance? Well, absolutely. Well, do you earn more than $30,000 a year? Because $30,000 a year puts you in the top 1% for the entire planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Which is everyone in America.
That's every American. Yep. Even the people who are just bilking the government in this way we were just talking about. That's all of us. And yeah, that's, I don't understand that misapplication that way. So I'm glad it was explained, because that it if you read the parable, it's well, and if you read other parts of the Bible, it's very clear that Jesus came to save all who believe. So yeah, even rich people, but yes,
no qualifiers where he was like, no, you know,
ultra rich,
you got more cars than days of the week. No, yeah. You can't make it. Heaven on earth now. All right. So why did I actually look this up? One, because I'm a history nerd and I think it's worth sharing. And we've had feedback from the American Radicals podcast audience that they appreciate the history lessons. But I also, in Saturdays prior, when we've been covering down on the First Amendment, Garrett in last Saturday talked about the Pentagon Papers. And I was really unfamiliar with it, other than it was just this term that I knew it's something in history that I wanted to learn about. So I started to dig into it and wound up coming across the actual history of the Continental Navy and Marines coming forward. But I want to get back to the Pentagon Papers. And I found this video. It's a little bit longer than we typically like to play. It's about 4 minutes long, but it gives a summation of what actually happened there. And I want to give it a play because there is a direct correlation to what Garrett's experience was as a whistleblower. And we can then provide you some more context to what our experiences are and how the standard that was set with this particular guy who brought out this material pertaining to the Vietnam War is being completely flipped on its head now. So we'll give this a play, and then we'll have a longer, more robust discussion on the Pentagon Papers.
On Sunday, June 13th, 1971, the New York Times published a report that would change history.
Their source was Daniel Ellsberg, a military analyst working for the government. And the report, which would soon become known as the Pentagon Papers, included top secret and incriminating information about the Vietnam War. Between 1967 and 1969, Ellsberg worked on a classified project for the government called United States-Vietnam Relations 1945-1967, a study prepared by the Department of Defense. The Pentagon Papers were not a good look for the United States government. Ellsberg research showed that there were many military miscalculations and even flat-out lies told by politicians about U.S. involvement in Vietnam. But why did Ellsberg decide to leak the papers to the New York Times? While working on the project, he realized he no longer supported the Vietnam War and thought it was unwinnable. In October of 1969, concerned that the public was being lied to, he began photocopying the report. He leaked some documents to members of Congress, but none of them went public. So in 1970, Ellsberg leaked portions to the New York Times and the Washington Post. The Pentagon Papers revealed that the government had been involved in Vietnam through several presidencies, unbeknownst to the American people. As early as 1950, the Truman administration gave military aid to France against the Viet Minh. In 1954, President Eisenhower sent aircraft and military assistance to Vietnam. By that time, the U.S. was covering 80% of France's military expenses in Indochina. President Kennedy adopted a policy of broad commitment to the war in Vietnam, even though the American people had been told U.S. involvement would be very limited. Then, President Lyndon B. Johnson waged military operations against North Vietnam. He began planning war in 1964, a full year before the depth of U.S. involvement was revealed to the public. In 1971, when the New York Times broke the story, President Nixon quickly obtained a court injunction from a federal judge in New York, stopping the Times from printing any more articles. He argued that publishing the Pentagon Papers would limit the president's ability to guard national security. The Times adhered to the restraining order, but they filed an appeal. Meanwhile, Katharine Graham, head of the Washington Post, started publishing articles about the Pentagon Papers instead. Nixon tried to stop the Post as well, but unlike the judge in New York, the DC judge refused to issue an injunction. This allowed the Post to continue publishing about the secret report. The inconsistency between the Post and Times cases quickly brought both papers to trial in the Supreme Court. The court decided that under the freedom of press, the government did not have a strong enough case to censor the press. Nixon lost the fight, and the articles were printed. Ellsberg was still indicted under the Espionage Act for leaking government secrets. He could have been sentenced to 115 years in prison, but the charges were dropped after evidence of governmental misconduct came to light. Although the Pentagon Papers did not include any details on Nixon's conduct in Vietnam, the president was embarrassed by the publications. He subsequently sought to discredit Ellsberg by using a team he called plumbers. They broke into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to try to uncover embarrassing or harmful information that might make Ellsberg look bad. This was the same group of burglars who'd become famous for their role in the Watergate scandal. It didn't work. Ellsberg was free, and together with the New York Times, set a new precedent for the press, a responsibility to tell the truth, even if it means publishing classified documents.
All right. That's a pretty good summation, I thought, better than I could do. But I thought that it was important because, one, the history of the United States' involvement in Vietnam being exposed was a major, major bombshell. But then the latter portion, the president himself going after this whistleblower and using the same team that he used during Watergate. I mean, it's an amazing story, and I think has a lot of, let's say, maybe history didn't repeat, but there's a lot of rhymes that went on with your own experience.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, our government has been weaponized for a long time. I if you don't think that that's the case, you're probably listening to the wrong show, because it's, I mean, we bring up historical examples all the time. And I guess furthermore, it goes to the heart of man. You know, it, no one can understand it. It's wicked. It's wicked above all things. And these people, these plumbers even, you know that that's wrong. You know that that's wrong to do, but they did it anyways, because the president told them to. Like, it's mind-boggling to me. There's a movie reference for you for Blades of Glory. But yeah, it's the similarities are interesting, because this case actually played a large role in again, why I sit here before you today. As most of you probably know a little bit of the background as to why I'm here, but some of the more detailed parts, I've talked about this stuff before, you know, on podcasts or whatever, but the day I was suspended, so we're at like 19, 20 months now, something like that. September 26th, 2022. And I was reporting to my new unit. This unit I was really excited about. It had a selection process. When I was in Kansas, I had to go back to Virginia to try out for it. There's like a two-day assessment. And I was one of the ones who was picked, which was pretty cool, I thought. And I think it would have been pretty cool. But I show up, you know, fast forward a few months after that, I show up and I'm thinking I'm going to report. Well, I get escorted into a different side office, and there's two guys in there who I assume are FBI agents, but they didn't furnish any ID to me. And they started asking me questions, and the questions all revolved around things I had made protected disclosures about. And one of those protected disclosures was, so the things they brought up were things that ended up into like, you know, publications or whatever. And the big one they focused on, and we've talked about this before, and I do highly encourage you to go back to Kerry Pickett's article from the Washington Times in November of 2023. And there's detail in there about it as well from a different whistleblower who came forward, and I don't know, I guess we'll see where that goes, but it pretty much exonerates me and everything I've been saying since the beginning, that I never leaked to Project Veritas or any other media outlet, but that's what I was accused of. And so they asked me these questions, and I'm like, nope, I made protected disclosures about those things. I, you know, that's eventually it was essentially just that, like, okay. And then a couple other FBI agents came in, because I'm assuming that's what those guys were too, probably from SecD. And, you know, then my creds, my gun, my badge, all that was seized, and I was escorted out. And, you know, here I've been ever since, existing in the ether, waiting for them to resolve the, you know, their alleged internal investigation, which they probably never will. But yeah, you want to chime in for a sec, and then I'll.
Yeah, I have a, well, I don't know. I've ever, never even asked you this. Do you think that your admission to acceptance to that new unit was actually contrived to maximize the penalty on you, knowing that you would require a move? What, I don't know if the timetable fits that well, or if it just happened to be those guys did an honest assessment and said, you were the guy.
Yeah, it's something I have thought about a lot, and I don't think so, because of the timeline in my head. And now part of it I can't trust, because on my suspension paperwork, they claimed that the internal investigation was started in August. Well, I accepted the transfer in like the first week of June. So I don't think so, but it could be. It's something that I don't know if we'll ever know for sure, but that could have been part of it, but I don't know. I've never been 100% on that.
I think though that the larger issue is that the comparison to the Pentagon Papers, where this guy went to the media. We don't know if he went to anybody in Congress or anybody in his chain of command, followed the law at the time as it was set up for whistleblower protection. But we know he went to the media, and the Supreme Court weighed in on that and said that the media could release those documents, and ultimately exonerated him when the president went after him.
Right. Think
you
of that.
Do that. The allegation is that you did.
Right.
But let's just grant the premise that Garrett's a big, giant, big, fat liar. And he went to Project Veritas. And even though he was having an interview with them where his face was blacked out and he was not saying anything related to it, this would have been a pretty good tell that it was you, by the way.
Yeah.
But let's say that's you. The Supreme Court's already weighed in on this. There's precedent for that is protected. The information can be published, and that you would not face any ramifications if there is a system set up for precedents. But nevertheless, it still hasn't stopped any insinuations that you've been referred over to the Department of Justice for prosecution.
Right. And this is where it gets even more interesting, as it were. So let's see, when would this have been? 3 weeks maybe after Steve and I testified, an article hit the news waves that I was being referred criminally to the DOJ for perjury and obstruction, I believe were the two. I know perjury was one of them, but I think it was perjury and obstruction. And that was all based off of our dear friend, retired Assistant Director of Human Resources, Jennifer Moore's testimony, which was under oath, by the way. So she did a transcribed interview, much like Steve and I did before we testified, under oath. And she claimed that the FBI had already determined that I was the Project Veritas whistleblower. So Stacey Plaskett and Jerry Nadler used that testimony, which I would attest is perjury itself, to refer me criminally to DOJ. And I say that because, like I've said all along, I never did leak to Project Veritas or anywhere else for that matter. And Jennifer Moore claimed that they had already determined that I did. But this is why I referenced the Kerry Pickett article from November. We have this whistleblower come forward who was working on my case, and they have said that, which this story gets crazy, and I won't get into too much of it yet because some of it I think needs to stay reserved for now, but there will be more details to come eventually. Rest assured of that. And so this whistleblower said that before I ever even reported to Virginia, they already had determined, well, the supervisor on the case, which I've talked about before too. You can go to my Substack, lastline.substack.com. Go back to November. I did an audio 15-minute basically reaction to this Kerry Pickett article. But the supervisor on the case, a guy named Sean Clark, who's also retired. So now think of this. I should have pulled up the law. There is a statute that governs this. Jennifer Moore, Sean Clark, they are retired. They will get their retirement going forward, regardless of what comes out of this case, regardless of the malfeasance that is shown that they participated in against me and against Kyle and Steve and Marcus as well, and others too. But so she does, you know, she tests, or Sean Clark's retired. So this whistleblower says, yeah, before he even showed up in Virginia, the supervisor over the case, Sean Clark, had already determined that he did not leak to Project Veritas. But that's what they suspended me for anyways, an allegation that I did. And now this, I'll let you chime in, but this is now where we will get a little bit in back to Pentagon Papers and why it's so important to my particular individual protected disclosures.
You've talked about it before, the it was a January 6th case that you were assigned where they had the facial recognition of the driver's license photo for the subject that was 20 years old. And you were going back and forth on the phone with this person saying, that's not accurate. This is old photo. You might have a facial recognition match with the 20-year-old photo with the current subject, but the guy that I'm looking at, he resembles nothing like that. Then you need an updated. And they kept saying to you, but you have a match. So now you're duty bound to just keep digging, even though you know that that is not your guy. And that's immediately where I went to in my mind when you're describing your experience, because I would bet you that a similar conversation was had that they said, hey, we know Garrett didn't leak. He's not the guy. But they say, but you have an allegation.
He's the guy.
You have an allegation. Yeah. The fact that we have an allegation is enough for us to use the process. The process is the punishment, and we're going to suspend him anyway because we are mad at him for making legally protected whistleblower disclosures, but we can't do that. What's our hack going to be? Well, we have an allegation. Who made that allegation? I don't know.
Nobody knows.
Someone over at security division. This mm-hmm. the guy in the cubicle next door. Hey, buddy, I need you to make an allegation real quick. Perfect. Yep. Thanks.
Yep. Yeah, it's crazy. So, man, yeah, this is crazy. So last night I was working on a Substack post, and I'll get into. I think I've mentioned this recently too. Like I've been working on some. I know I haven't published any in a while, but I'm gonna have something really interesting coming up. It'll be a daily thing that I'll do. But last night, the one I was working on, I was talking about Elijah and Ahab. And I don't know if people are aware of this story, but Queen Jezebel is involved as well, and she was a wicked queen, and Ahab was a wicked king. But essentially, Jezebel had two people to just bear false witness against this guy named Naboth, because Ahab wanted his vineyard, and Ahab was the king. But he wouldn't just seize it, but he really wanted it. So Jezebel basically used her authority as queen to bear false witness against Naboth, and she had these two CHSs, is what I refer to them in this post that'll come out eventually. And so confidential human sources, and the Bible calls them like scoundrels or like wicked men. So they're evil, and they're like these the plumbers that we were talking about with Nixon. They're just going to do it because the queen or king said so, because the president said so, because we don't like what this person is doing because it's contrary to what we think our best interests are. So Naboth wanted to retain his vineyard. You and I wanted to make protected disclosures in accordance with law. So they're going to do it anyways, and they're going to use wicked people to bear false witness. And that's exactly what they've done. And so, you know, this allegation is made, which has been false from the start. And another part of this that I think is so important that we kind of gloss over sometimes. We're at like 19, 20 months, at least 20 since they've opened their investigation, which, by the way, it's also an FBI policy violation to permit someone to transfer when they're under an administrative inquiry, which I was. But they let us sell our house. They let us move into an Airbnb and rack up tens of thousands of dollars of debt between all of this. And they did it all intentionally based off of an Eighth Amendment violation, Eighth Commandment violation of bearing false witness. So that's what happened. And yeah, you feel free, chime in here, because I'm getting to the Pentagon Papers, I swear.
The Jennifer Moore aspect, where she went in and either did one of two things, neither of which is good. She either committed some sort of perjury when she testified to the House Judiciary Weaponization Committee that they knew you were the person, or she'd admitted to the FBI's internal investigation being completely incompetent because they came to the wrong conclusion, which has now been verified by someone from on the inside. Neither one of those is very good, and there's been no accountability there. She went to work for General Electric as a security chief, and then, you know, my connection is she let her buddy, my former special agent in charge of Jacksonville field office, Sherry Onks, got her hired as well as a member of the security team out on the West Coast. So she's out there profiting. And she was one who was subpoenaed to testify and said she had to go get like LASIK surgery and couldn't make it. And that flew. And then she retired and they've never called her back to testify.
Never called her back. How about that? Oh man, it's so frustrating because of the injustice. And I've done it before, cited verses about that. I've got a different section for today that I'll get to probably a little bit later, but there's so many, and it's something I struggle with, is you see this wickedness and this injustice, but we know that they will have their day. And if not in court on earth, they will have their day in God's court. And honestly, I pray for them. I pray for them to turn to Christ because it's the only way. And if someday I can have a reunion with them in heaven and all sins from earth be gone and washed away and forgot, that would be great. I won't hold my breath on that. But these people need Christ. And I struggle sometimes with my own, human sin, my own sin nature, because me, the sinful me, wants vengeance and anger and malice and destruction for them. But those aren't my things to obtain. Those are God's, and his justice will be the most supreme justice that ever comes. Also kind of interesting, this article, the one I'm thinking of, or the first time I remember hearing of it was like June 8th. Jennifer Moore's testimony or transcribed interview was on June 3rd, and her retirement was effective on June 4th. Isn't that curious? That sure makes me suspicious of some things. But to the topic at hand, Pentagon Papers, I'm going to pull this up. So some of you also may know this. September 26, 2022, that's when I was suspended. Fast forward like a week or two, like sometime in early mid-October, I was given the quote-unquote opportunity to appeal the decision. And there was a written appeal. And as part of that written appeal, my attorney at the time said, hey, try to get former colleagues of yours to essentially write a correlative statement to yours. And so I had an outline that he wanted me to touch on. You've heard me mention these adjudicative guidelines before. There's 13 of them. That's what it governs security clearance holders. And any of those 13 can be used to suspend a clearance. And the FBI used two or three of those in my case. And so I wrote about some of that stuff and some other things in there. This is where I included James 4:17 for the person who knows the right thing to do it and fails at it. For him, it is sin. I reference that all the time because that is the crux of this. As an FBI agent, as a Christian, as a father, as a husband, how can I wake up every day, put a gun and badge on my hip and go knowingly that go to work knowingly, having information that the FBI is violating law, rule, or regulation, or some of these other five major categories of protected disclosures. And so I touch on all of this stuff. And then I submit that. And I was able to get like seven guys that I used to work with, which I don't talk to them really, hardly at all, any of them. Well, maybe one of them regularly, I guess, and maybe two or three of them on occasion. But they all did it because they knew me. And they knew, I'm sure they knew, like, oh, this is kind of a risk to me because I don't really want to be associated with him, but how can I not? You know, and I'm grateful they all did. So then we enter into this oral part of the appeal, and it was a phone call. And, you know, all these people get on the call and state their position and name and title and just sit there quietly while AD Michael Schneider, who is another one of these evil tyrants, which maybe we'll get into a little bit more of that another time. But and I have no problem naming him because he's an assistant director. You can look him up and there'll be public information about him. But he basically reads off of a script, and then I get my turn to speak. But guess what? I'm not allowed to address the merits of the suspension. Well, that's weird. What's the point of this appeal then? And I essentially said that. And there was like a little moment of silence. And then he basically went back to the script and we wrapped up the call. And then fast forward into some of our earlier administrative proceedings through the MSPB, the Merit Systems Protection Board. And in those early court filings to the MSPB, the FBI submitted my written declaration and the seven supporter declarations that I had. And once you know it, the vast majority of all of those were redacted because they addressed the merits. So I'll bring to you right now part of my written declaration and why it is important to the Pentagon Papers and my overall story as a whistleblower. And so this is addressing Guideline K, handling protected information. And I wrote, for those of you who are just listening, the agents who interviewed me stated I had accessed the Project Veritas case in late 2021. If my memory serves correctly, I'd accessed that case in November 2021. Based on reporting in the media, I believe the DOJ and FBI to be engaging in biased targeting of a journalistic entity and minimally conducting themselves contrary to established Supreme Court precedent. See New York Times versus United States, 1971, among others. That right there is the Pentagon Papers case. I had already known of that case because, as you guys know from the last couple of weeks, we'd been doing First Amendment stuff. Case law has always been important to me in my law enforcement career. Constitutional law was my favorite class in college. And yeah, it's important. I think it should be supremely important to anybody in law enforcement, but clearly we know it isn't. So I go on and I say, based on this reasonable belief, I looked up Project Veritas and found a case out of the New York field office. The case was designated a sensitive investigative matter, a SIM, for being, quote, news media. So I already had a reasonable belief that the FBI and the DOJ were violating the law based on New York Times versus United States 1971, the Pentagon Papers case. So now I see that they designated Project Veritas a SIM for being news media. So now my reasonable belief is bolstered even more. But I continue and I write, I was aware that the DOJ had claimed Project Veritas was, quote, not engaged in journalism within any traditional or accepted definition of that word, end quote. That comes from one of DOJ's court filings against Project Veritas in the Ashley Biden case. But I continue and I say, based on these circumstances, I believe the DOJ and FBI to be participating in at least three of the five major categories of wrongdoing regarding making a protected disclosure. One, any violation of any law, rule, or regulation. Two, gross mismanagement. And three, an abuse of authority. Shortly after arriving at this conclusion, I reported this and other information to Congress in November of 2021. I have never provided any internal information to any news media. I would not intentionally mishandle protected information. I have never received security counseling or training because of my actions and do not believe there is a pattern since I have never provided information to any media outlet. But nonetheless, I'm willing to participate in security counseling or training to clarify any unclear standards regarding the captioned guidelines. And I mean, there's more because I think in total, I wrote like, I don't know, seven pages or something. And that's just, you know, two or three paragraphs. But of course, none of this has ever been addressed. we're into 20 months. You know, I'm an evil bad guy, worse than Ellsberg probably, and they want to throw me under the gulag. But yeah, so that's a little bit as to why the Pentagon Papers is a vastly important case, and just personally to me, you know, because of this thread. Oh, you're muted.
Yeah, I didn't. You were talking about the additional security counseling there. I don't know if you were ever thrown the same term, because I was certainly thrown the term security awareness briefing, and was told that I needed to participate in that. And it was pretty clear to me in my conversations with the assistant special agent in charge that it was punitive in nature. And they said, well, you made different decisions than other people, so you're going to have to do repetitious training that you've already done before. And when I said that, you definitely are singling me out now for some sort of retaliation.
Yeah, you're going to retaliate against me because I made different decisions. Okay, because I'm not a coward. All right.
So it seems to me that there's a playbook when it comes to going after the overlaps of our experiences, even though the allegations of what we did wrong were very different. It doesn't really matter because they're not really creative. They just are the guy at the poker table who has a lot of chips, and they're not really good at cards. They just have the ability to lean on the other players with their gigantic resources and reputation.
Yeah, like I this playbook idea, it's the Kansas City Chiefs, that's the FBI. They're running the same playbook against the Jacksonville Jaguars and against the Green Bay Packers. You know, sure, the teams are a little different and some of the details are a little different, but their playbook remains the same and they're going to run it.
Yeah, and they're very good and efficient at it. They've basically been undefeated because they get to rule on their own rulings, and wouldn't you know it, they rule with their own rulings are just fine. Well, that's sort of, I think, a nice correlation to history and how it has a way of repeating itself. But as opposed to what we saw with the Pentagon Papers, Garrett's fate is still in limbo. And hopefully that there's some sort of justice that prevails in the end. But, you know, from what we've gotten in our experiences with dealing with our elected officials, I don't know, man. I'm kind of throwing my hands up and saying there's no white knight coming. There's no savior in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
We're just going to have to figure out another way around it, which is why I'm trying to get engaged at state levels. But I, you know, who knows what the actual course of action is going to be. I do have a palate cleanse for us today, but we have neglected to thank the show sponsor. So I want to do that. And then we'll be ready to close it out here on a Saturday. The show sponsor is True Earth Pharmacy. You can go to trueearth.co. And you can use our promo code, which is AMRAD24, because we are getting healthy in 2024 on the American Radicals podcast. And you can use that on all of their supplements and their fertilizer products. They use their fertilizer products to grow their supplements. It's all in-house. I have a supply of several of their items and can tell you firsthand that they do work, and they work pretty quickly. It's not one of these things where, you know, you'll see results in 6 to 8 weeks. I saw results in 6 to 8 days. Pain in my feet and ankles went completely away. I no longer have to hobble down the steps. So if and when the FBI bangs on my door at 6 o'clock in the morning, I will get there before they breach the door. So go to trueearth.co, use promo code AMRAD24, and you can get 10% off. Also, plug the-suspendables.com, Garrett's merch store. I think he's basically dug out of all the back orders. He sent me a care package. I've got some good beta shirts, so I know his creative juices are flowing there. Garrett, you want to add anything to this?
Yeah, I'm always coming up with stuff. I've got a lot of ideas, and I got a lot of it ready to go. But I've realized after the Beck effect that, because I actually added some designs. I added the Make Whistleblowers Great Again design in a couple different colorways, and I added the Kyle Serafin Show design in a couple different colorways. Somebody actually reached out and said, hey, you got to add an AMRAD pod design. Of course, I do. I have one ready. I just need to get it up there. But I've realized with our limited capacity for storage and whatnot, I need to get through some of these ones that are currently available before I add anything else. Other than, you know, here or there, maybe like a new sticker pack or something small, I'll keep adding. But rest assured, there are plenty of designs because those creative juices are always flowing. And by all means, we're all caught up. So keep them coming. Bring orders whenever. We'll wait for them. Sometimes it'll take a week or two. Sometimes if you order kind of near the back end of when I'm like printing shirts and packaging orders, you might get it, you know, within a week. But, you know, rest assured, they will, if you order, it will ship eventually. And then one last thing for me before your palate cleanse, because I mentioned it and it's been on my mind. And I think it's what I like to call one of my biblical whistleblowers. Maybe someday I'll write the book on that. But it comes from Jeremiah chapter 26. And I think it's just really pertinent, again, an Old Testament prophet, and the similarities between our own nation and what was happening back then. And honestly, I think it's every government that's ever existed goes down this wicked path, because we know from elsewhere in scripture that this earth is Satan's dominion. This is his domain. And so starting in verse 2 of chapter 26 in Jeremiah, it says, "Thus says the Lord, stand in the court of the Lord's house and speak to all the cities of Judah that come to worship in the house of the Lord." What a task that is, hey? And it says, "All the words that I command you to speak to them, do not hold back a word. It may be they will listen and everyone turn from his evil way, that I may relent of the disaster that I intend to do them because of their evil deeds. You shall say to them, thus says the Lord, if you will not listen to me to walk in my law that I have set before you and to listen to the words of my servants, the prophets whom I send to you urgently, though you have not listened, then I will make this house like Shiloh and I will make this city a curse for all the nations of the earth." The priests and the prophets and all the people heard Jeremiah speaking these words in the house of the Lord. And when Jeremiah had finished speaking all that the Lord had commanded him to speak to all the people, then the priests and the prophets and all the people laid hold of him, saying, "You shall die." And I'll stop there for now. You can read more of it on your own if you want. But here he is, Jeremiah, the prophet. They call him the weeping prophet because nobody ever listened. And Judah fell into more wickedness and eventually were overtaken and overrun and didn't turn from their wicked ways. And he lamented that. He also is the author of Lamentations. The whole book is a lament. But he did what was right. He did what the Lord commanded him to do. And he spoke to the authorities, because in their system, their governmental system was their religious system. It was all one. It wasn't like it is here. And so he spoke to the authorities and said, "Turn from your wicked ways." And they didn't listen. And instead they said, "You shall die." And in a lot of ways, I think it's just important to tie in, because look at what your government is doing. They're making you fund your own demise. They're saying you shall die if you speak out against them, if you have a biblical worldview, if you say, no, there are only two genders, because that's what the Bible says, if you don't wave the LGBTQ+ flag, if you whistleblow, if you like your Second Amendment, if you like your First Amendment, all these things that we talk about. So I just want to end on that note, because there is still hope, because it says right there, they maybe they'll turn. Maybe they'll turn from their wicked ways, and we can work towards that goal. It's like we talk about, Steve. We don't get to pick the hill. The hill picks us. We just obey. And so we speak the truth. Hopefully, more often than not, we speak it in love. And we go forward saying, hey, you can come at me however you want, but I'm going to stand firm on the truth. We must.
We continue to lament the things that we see, and hopefully someone in a position of authority takes note and implements some sort of change. But you know, that's on them. That's their hill, not ours. We'll just continue to bang the drum, which is the mind meld is complete. It's in keeping with the sort of the palate cleanse of the day. Earlier this week, I played a song of the Richmond North of Richmond parody.
My wife loved that, by the way. She's like, that's so awesome.
It was really well done. I went through Remy's catalog and found this one as well. It's sort of a response to the Jason Aldean, "Try That in a Small Town." It's a "Try That in a Large Town." This is the sort of wickedness that we're seeing from a comedic angle, from an artistic angle. And we'll give this a play and then close it out here on Saturday.
Despite the controversy, the song has gained popularity, something other musicians are keen to capitalize on.
Open a lemonade stand on the sidewalk, go for a long walk in the middle of the night. Keep schools open so that kids can keep on learning. You think it's cool, we'll act a fool if you like. Put someone's groceries in a bag that doesn't immediately break. don't bake a penis cake. We'll try that in a large town. See how far you make it down the road. Around here we're punishing our own. You cross that line, it won't take long for you to find out. I recommend you don't try that in a large town. Call the line for 9 emergencies, 'cause somebody's dropping trousers on your daisies. That stuff might fly in the country. Good luck. Try that in a large town. See how far you make it down the road. Around here we speed camera our own. You cross that line, it won't take long for you to find out. I recommend you don't try that in a large town.
I'm moving to a small town. How about you, Garrett?
It's awesome. These are great. You come up with some of the best stuff.
I'm just good at finding it. These guys are seriously creative. He's a very gifted musician and singer. So for his full catalog, again, he's on YouTube. His name is Remy, R-E-M-Y. He works for Reason TV. Check out everything he puts out. I mean, it always puts a smile on my face. As awful as the content that he's covering, I can't stop laughing whenever he does it. So that'll do it today as we have covered in on the whistleblower history. Hope that you all enjoyed it as much as we did. We are the history nerds. We like to bring you that and then bring it home with the connection to our own experiences. And then in the end, it all ties back to the biblical worldview. And Garrett did such a great job of closing us out with that and leaving you with a smile on your face today. So enjoy the rest of your weekend. And the American Radicals podcast will be with you back on Tuesday, 8:30 Eastern time. Until then, make sure that you have a safe and blessed Saturday and Sunday. See you next week.
You've been listening to the voice of the Suspendables on the American Radicals podcast. Follow us on rumble.com/amradpod.